Today, to celebrate Martin Luther King Day, and most of this week, we're going to be playing selections from the speeches and sermons of Dr. Martin Luther King. He was born on January 15th, 1929. He entered Morehouse College at age 15 and at 19 was ordained a Baptist minister. He received his doctorate in theology at 25 and became pastor of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. This week, we're devoting a large portion of the Santa Fe Radio Cafe to Dr. King's speeches and sermons. The first one is Birth of a New Nation, a sermon delivered at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama, on April 7, 1957, when King was 28 years old. The Montgomery bus boycott, which woke the conscience of the nation and during which Dr. King and other black leaders' houses had been bombed, had ended a few months earlier, but terrorism against African Americans continued. We won't be able to play the sermon in its entirety. It begins with the biblical story of Exodus and stories of colonialism in Africa. Now, Birth of a New Nation.
That is a great day ahead. The future is on its side. It's going now through the wilderness, but the promised land is ahead. Now, I want to take just a few more minutes as I close to say three or four things that this reminds us of and things that it says to us, things that we must never forget as we ourselves find ourselves breaking loose from an evil Egypt, trying to move through the wilderness toward the promised land of cultural integration. Ghana has something to say to us. It says to us first that the oppressor never voluntarily gives freedom to the oppressed. You have to work for it. And if Nkrumah and the people of the Gold Coast had not stood up persistently revolting against the system, it would still be a colony of the British Empire. Freedom is never given to anybody, for the oppressor has you in domination because he plans to keep you there, and he never voluntarily gives it up. And that is where the strong resistance comes. Privileged classes never give up their privileges without strong resistance. And so don't go out this morning with any illusion. Don't go back into your homes and around Montgomery thinking that the Montgomery City Commission and that all of the forces in the leadership of the South will eventually work out this thing for Negroes. It's going to work out. It's going to roll in on the wheels of inevitability. If we wait for it to work itself out, it will never be worked out. Freedom only comes through persistent revolt, through persistent agitation, through persistently rising up against the system of evil. Bus protest is just the beginning. Buses are integrated in Montgomery, but that is just the beginning. And don't sit down and do nothing now because the buses are integrated. Because if you stop now, we will be in the dungeons of segregation and discrimination for another 100 years. And our children and our children's children will suffer all of the bondage that we have lived under for years. It never comes voluntarily. We've got to keep on keeping on in order to gain freedom. It never comes like that. It would be fortunate if the people in power had sense enough to go on and give up, but they don't do it like that. It is not done voluntarily, but it is done through the pressure that comes about from people who are oppressed. If there had not been a Gandhi in India with all of his noble followers, India would have never been free. If there had not been an Nkrumah and his followers in Ghana, Ghana would still be a British colony. If there had not been abolitionists in America, both Negro and white, we might still stand today in the dungeons of slavery. Been because there have been in every period, there are always those people in every period of human history who don't mind getting their necks cut off, who don't mind being persecuted and discriminated and kicked about because because they know that freedom is never given out, but it comes through the persistent and the continual agitation and revolt on the part of those who are caught in the system. Garner teaches us that. It says to us another thing. It reminds us of the fact that a nation or a people can break loose from oppression without violence. Nkrumah says in the first two pages of his autobiography, which was published on the 6th of March, a great book which you ought to read, he said that he had studied the social systems of social philosophers. He started studying the life of Gandhi and his techniques. And he said that in the beginning, he could not see how they could ever get loose from colonialism without armed revolt, without armies and ammunition rising up. Then he says, after he continued to study Gandhi, continued to study this technique, he came to see that the only way was through non-violent positive action. And he called his program Positive Action. And it's a beautiful thing, isn't it? That here is a nation that is now free, and it is free without rising up with arms and with ammunition. It is free through non-violent means. Because of that, the British Empire will not have the bitterness for Ghana that she has for China, so to speak. Because of that, when the British Empire leaves Ghana, she leaves with a different attitude than she would have left with if she had been driven out by armies. We've got to revolt in such a way that after revolt is over, we can live with people as our brothers and our sisters. Our aim must never be to defeat them or humiliate them. On the night of the state ball, standing up talking with some people, Mordecai Johnson called my attention to the fact that Prime Minister Kwame Nkrumah was out dancing with the Duchess of Kent. I said, isn't this something? Here it is, the once slave, now dancing with the Lord on an equal plane. And that is done because that is no bitterness. These two nations will be able to live together and work together because the breaking of loose was through nonviolence and not through violence. The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community. The aftermath of nonviolence is redemption. The aftermath of nonviolence is reconciliation. The aftermath of violence, however, is bitterness. And this is the thing I'm concerned about. Let us fight passionately and unrelentingly for the goal of justice and freedom. But let's be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle. Let us never fight with falsehood and violence and hate and malice, but always fight with love, so that when the day comes that the walls of segregation have completely crumbled in Montgomery, that we will be able to live with people as our brothers and sisters. Oh, my friends, our aim must be not to defeat Mr. Engelhardt, not to defeat Mr. Sellers and Mr. Gale and Mr. Parks. Our aim must be to defeat the evil that's in them. But our aim must be to win the friendship of Mr. Gale and Mr. Sellers and Mr. Engelhardt. We must come to the point of seeing that our ultimate aim is to live with all men as brothers and sisters under God and not be their enemies or anything that goes with that type of relationship. This is one thing that Garner teaches us, that you can break loose from evil through nonviolence, through a lack of bitterness. And Nkrumah says in his book, when I came out of prison, I was not bitter toward Britain. I came out merely with a determination to free my people from the colonialism and imperialism that had been inflicted upon them by Britain. But I came out with no bitterness. because of that, this world will be a better place in which to live. There's another thing that God will remind us. I'm coming to the conclusion now. God reminds us that freedom never comes on a silver platter. It's never easy. God reminds us that whenever you break out of Egypt, you better get ready for stiff battle. You better get ready for some homes to be bombed. You better get ready for some churches to be bombed. You better get ready for a lot of nasty things to be said about you, because you're getting out of Egypt, and whenever you break loose from Egypt, the initial response of the Egyptian is bitterness. It never comes with ease. It comes only through the hardness and persistence of life. God reminds us of that. You better get ready to go to prison. When I looked out and saw the prime minister there with his prison cap on that night, that reminded me of that fact, that freedom never comes easy. It comes through hard labor, and it comes through toil. It comes through hours of despair and disappointment. That's the way it goes. That is no crown without a cross. I wish we could get to Easter without going to Good Friday, but history tells us that we got to go by Good Friday before we can get to Easter. That's the long story of freedom, isn't it? Before you get to Cana, you got a Red Sea to confront. You have a hardened heart of a Pharaoh to confront. You have the prodigious hilltops of evil in the wilderness to confront. And even when you get up through the promised land, you have giants in the land. The beautiful thing about it is that there are a few people who've been over in the land. They have spied enough to say, even though the giants are there, we can possess the land, because we got the internal fiber to stand up amid anything that we have to face. The road to freedom is a difficult, hard road. It always makes for temporary setbacks. Those people who tell you today that there's more tension in Montgomery than there's ever been are telling you right. Whenever you get out of Egypt, you always confront a little tension. You always confront a little temporary setback. If you didn't confront that, you'd never get out. You must remember that that's the tensionless period that we like to think of was a period when the Negro was complacently adjusted to segregation, discrimination, insult, and exploitation. And the period of tension is the period when the Negro has decided to rise up and break loose from that. And this is a peace that we are seeking, not an old negative, obnoxious peace, which is merely the absence of tension, but a positive, lasting peace, which is the presence of brotherhood and justice. And it is never brought about without this temporary period of tension. The road to freedom is difficult. Finally, Garner tells us that the forces of the universe are on the side of justice. That's what it tells us now. You can interpret Garner any kind of way you want to, but Garner tells me that the forces of the universe are on the side of justice. That night when I saw that old flag coming down and the new flag coming up, I saw something else. That wasn't just an ephemeral, evanescent event appearing on the stage of history, but it was an event with eternal meaning, for it symbolizes something. That thing symbolized to me that an old order is passing away. A new order is coming into being. An old order of colonialism, of segregation and discrimination is passing away now. And a new order of justice and freedom and goodwill being born. That's what it said. Somehow the forces of justice stand on the side of the universe, and that you can't ultimately trample over God's children and profit by it. I want to come back to Montgomery now, but I must stop by London for a moment. London reminds me of something. And I never will forget the day we went into London. The next day we started moving around this great city, the only city in the world that is almost as large as New York City. Over 8 million people in London, about 8,300,000. New York, about 8,500,000. London larger in area than New York, though. Standing London is an amazing picture. And I never will forget the experience I had. The thoughts that came to my mind, we went to Buckingham Palace. And I looked there at all of Britain, with all of the pomp and circumstance of royalty. And I thought about all of the queens and kings that have passed through here. Look at the beauty of the changing of the guards and all of the guards with their beautiful horses. It's a beautiful sight. Move on from that and go over to Parliament. Move into the House of Lords and the House of Commons. There, with all of its beauty standing up before the world, is one of the most beautiful sights in the world. And then I remember that we went on over to Westminster Abbey. I thought about several things when we went in this great church, this great cathedral, the center of the Church of England. We walked around and went to the tombs of the kings and queens buried there. Most of the kings and queens of England are buried right there in the Westminster Abbey. And I walked around. On the one hand, I enjoyed and appreciated the great Gothic architecture of that massive cathedral. I stood there in awe, thinking about the greatness of God and man's feeble attempt to reach up for God. But I thought something else. I thought about the Church of England. My mind went back to Buckingham Palace, and I said that this is the symbol of a dying system. There was a day that the queens and kings of England could boast that the sun never sets on the British Empire. Day when she occupied the greater portion of Australia, the greater portion of Canada. That was the day when she ruled most of China, most of Africa, and all of India. And I started thinking about this empire. I started thinking about the fact that she ruled over India one day. Mahatma Gandhi stood there at every hand trying to get the freedom of his people. And they never bowed to it. They decided that they were going to stand up and hold India in humiliation and in colonialism many, many years. I remember we passed by 10 Downing Street. That's the place where the Prime Minister of England lives. I remember that a few years ago a man lived there by the name of Winston Churchill. One day he stood up before the world and said, I did not become His Majesty's first minister to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire. I thought about the fact that a few weeks ago a man by the name of Anthony Eden lived there. And out of all of his knowledge of the Middle East, he decided to rise up and march his armies with the forces of Israel and France into Egypt. And there they confronted their doom, because they were revolting against world opinion. Egypt, a country with no military power. They could have easily defeated Egypt, but they did not realize that they were fighting more than Egypt. They were attacking world opinion. They were fighting the whole Asian African bloc, which is the bloc that now thinks and moves and determines the course of the history of the world. I thought of many things. I thought of the fact that the British Empire exploited India. Think about it. A nation with 400 million people, and the British exploited them so much that out of a population of 400 million, 350 million made an annual income of less than $50 a year. 25 of that had to be used for taxes and the other things of life. I thought about dark Africa and how the people there, they can make $100 a year. They are living very well, they think. 2 shillings a day. 1 shilling is 14 cents. 2 shillings, 28 cents. That's a good wage. That's because of the domination of the British Empire. All of these things came to my mind, and when I stood there in Westminster Abbey with all of its beauty, and I thought about all of the beautiful hymns and anthems that the people would go in there to sing. And yet the Church of England never took a stand against this system. The Church of England sanctioned it. The Church of England gave it moral backing. And all of the exploitation perpetuated by the British Empire was sanctioned by the Church of England. But something else came to my mind. God comes in the picture even when the church won't take a stand. God has injected a principle in this universe. God has said that all men must respect the dignity and worth of all human personality. And if you don't do that, I will take charge. It seems this morning that I can hear God speaking. I can hear him speaking throughout the universe, saying, be still and know that I'm God. And if you don't stop, if you don't straighten up, if you don't stop extorting people, I'm going to rise up and break the backbone of your power. And your power will be no more, and the power of Great Britain is no more. I looked at France. I looked at Britain, and I thought about the Britain that could boast the sun never sets on our great empire. And I say now she has gone to the level that the sun hardly rises on the British Empire, because it was based on exploitation. Because the God of the universe eventually takes a stand. And I say to you this morning, my friends, rise up and know that as you struggle for justice, you do not struggle alone. But God struggles with you. And he's working every day. Somehow I can look out. I can look out across the seas and across the universe and cry out, my eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He's tramping out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. Then I think about it, because his truth is marching on. And I can sing another chorus. Hallelujah. Glory, hallelujah. His truth is marching on. Then I can hear Isaiah again, because that has profound meaning to me. That somehow every valley shall be exalted, and every hill shall be made low. The plain, the crooked places shall be made straight, and the rough places plain. The glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. That's the beauty of this thing. All flesh shall see it together. Not some from the heights of Park Street and others from the dungeons of slum areas. Not some from the pinnacles of the British Empire and some from the dark deserts of Africa. Not some from inordinate, superfluous wealth and others from abject, deadening poverty. Not some white and not some black, not some yellow and not some brown, but all flesh shall see it together. They shall see it from Montgomery, they shall see it from New York, they shall see it from Ghana, they shall see it from China. For I can look out and see a great number, as John saw, marching into the great eternity, because God is working in this world and at this hour and at this moment. God granted we will get on board and start marching with God, because we got orders now to break down the bondage and the walls of colonialism, exploitation, and imperialism, to break them down to the point that no man will trample over another man, but that all men will respect the dignity and worth of all human personality. And then we will be in Canaan's freedom land. Moses might not get to see Canaan, but his children will see it. He even got to the mountaintop enough to see it, and that assured him that it was coming. But the beauty of the thing is that there's always a just way to take up his work and take the children on in. And it's there waiting with its milk and honey and with all of the bountiful beauty that God has in store for his children. Oh, what exceedingly marvelous things God has in store for us. Granted we would follow him enough to gain them. Oh God, our gracious Heavenly Father, help us to see the insights that come from this new nation. Help us to follow thee and all of thy creative work in this world. that somehow we will discover that we are made to live together as brothers, and that it will come in this generation, the day when all men will recognize the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. Amen.
That was Birth of a New Nation, a sermon by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama on April 7, 1957. We're going to hear now the address at the Prayer Pilgrimage for Freedom at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., delivered on May 17, 1957. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was president of the recently founded Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the nonviolent civil rights group that used protests, boycotts, and sit-ins to achieve its aims. The speech is often called Give Us the Ballot.
Mr. Chairman, distinguished platform associates, fellow Americans, three years ago, the Supreme Court of this nation rendered in simple, eloquent, and unequivocal language a decision which will long be stenciled on the mental sheets of succeeding generations. For all men of goodwill, this May 17th decision came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of human captivity. It came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of disinherited people throughout the world who had dared only to dream of freedom. Unfortunately, this noble and sublime decision has not gone without opposition. This opposition has often risen to ominous proportions. Many states have risen up in open defiance. The legislative halls of the South ring loud with such words as interposition and nullification. But even more, all types of conniving methods are still being used to prevent Negroes from becoming registered voters. The denial of this sacred right is a tragic betrayal of the highest mandates of our democratic tradition. So our most urgent request to the President of the United States and every member of Congress is to give us the right to vote. Give us the ballot. And we will no longer have to worry the federal government about our basic rights. Give us the ballot. And we will no longer plead to the federal government for passage of an anti-lynching law. We will, by the power of our vote, write the law on the statute books of the South and bring an end to the dastardly acts of the hooded perpetrators of violence. Give us the ballot, and we will transform the salient misdeeds of bloodthirsty mobs into the calculated good deeds of orderly citizens. Give us the ballot, and we will fill our legislative halls with men of goodwill and send to the sacred halls of Congress men who will not sign a Southern manifesto because of their devotion to the manifesto of justice. Give us the ballot, and we will place judges on the benches of the South who will do justly and love mercy. And we will place at the head of the Southern states governors who have felt not only the tang of the human, but the glow of the divine. Give us the ballot, and we will quietly and nonviolently, without rancor or bitterness, implement the Supreme Court's decision of May 17, 1954. In this juncture of our nation's history, there is an urgent need for dedicated and courageous leadership. If we are to solve the problems ahead and make racial justice a reality, this leadership must be fourfold. First, there is need for strong, aggressive leadership from the federal government. So far, only the judicial branch of the government has evinced this quality of leadership. If the executive and legislative branches of the government were as concerned about the protection of our citizenship rights as the federal courts have been, then the transition from a segregated to an integrated society would be infinitely smoother. But we so often look to Washington in vain for this concern. In the midst of the tragic breakdown of law and order, the executive branch of the government is all too silent and apathetic. In the midst of the desperate need for civil rights legislation, the legislative branch of the government is all too stagnant and hypocritical. This dearth of positive leadership from the federal government is not confined to one particular political party. Both political parties have betrayed the cause of justice. The Democrats have betrayed it by capitulating to the prejudices and undemocratic practices of the Southern Dixiecrats. The Republicans have betrayed it by capitulating to the blatant hypocrisy of right-wing reactionary Northerners. These men so often have a high blood pressure of words and an anemia of deeds. In the midst of these prevailing conditions, we come to Washington today pleading with the President and members of Congress to provide a strong moral and courageous leadership for a situation that cannot permanently be evaded. We come humbly to say to the men in the forefront of our government that the civil rights issue is not an ephemeral, evanescent domestic issue that can be kicked about by reactionary guardians of the status quo. It is rather an eternal moral issue which may well determine the destiny of our nation in the ideological struggle with communism. The hour is late. The clock of destiny is ticking out. We must act now before it is too late. A second area in which there is need for strong leadership is from the white Northern liberals. There is a dire need today for liberalism which is truly liberal. What we are witnessing today in so many Northern communities is a sort of quasi-liberalism which is based on the principle of looking sympathetically at all sides. It is a liberalism so bent on seeing all sides that it fails to become committed to either side. It is a liberalism that is so objectively analytical that it is not subjectively committed. It is a liberalism which is neither hot nor cold, but lukewarm. We call for a liberalism from the North which will be thoroughly committed to the ideal of racial justice and will not be deterred by the propaganda and subtle words of those who say, slow up for a while, you're pushing too fast. A third source that we must look to for strong leadership is from the moderates of the white South. It is unfortunate that at this time the leadership of the white South stems from the closed-minded reactionaries. These persons gain prominence and power by the dissemination of false ideas and by deliberately appealing to the deepest hate responses within the human mind. It is my firm belief that this closed-minded, reactionary, recalcitrant group constitutes a numerical minority. There are in the white South more open-minded moderates than appears on the surface. These persons are silent today because of fear of social, political, and economic reprisals. God grant that the white moderates of the South will rise up courageously, without fear, and take up the leadership in this tense period of transition. I cannot close without stressing the urgent need for strong, courageous, and intelligent leadership from the Negro community. We need a leadership that is calm and yet positive. This is no day for the rabble-rouser, whether he be Negro or white. We must realize that we are grappling with the most weighty social problem of this nation. And in grappling with such a complex problem, that is no place for misguided emotionalism. We must work passionately and unrelentingly for the goal of freedom. But we must be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle. We must never struggle with falsehood, hate, or malice. We must never become bitter. I know how we feel sometimes. That is the danger that those of us who have been forced so long to stand amid the tragic midnight of oppression, those of us who have been trampled over, those of us who have been kicked about, that is the danger that we will become bitter. But if we will become bitter and indulge in hate campaigns, the new order which is emerging will be nothing but a duplication of the old order. We must meet hate with love. We must meet physical force with soul force. That is still a voice crying out through the vista of time, saying, love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Pray for them that despitefully use you. Then and only then can you matriculate into the university of eternal life. That same voice cries out in turns lifted to cosmic proportions, he who lives by the sword will perish by the sword. And history is replete with the bleached bones of nations that failed to follow this command. We must follow nonviolence and love. Now, I'm not talking about a sentimental, shallow kind of love. I'm not talking about eros, which is a sort of aesthetic, romantic love. I'm not even talking about philia, which is a sort of intimate affection between personal friends. But I'm talking about agape. I'm talking about the love of God in the hearts of men. I'm talking about a type of love which will cause you to love the person who does the evil deed while hating the deed that the person does. We've got to love. That is another warning signal. We talk a great deal about our rights, and rightly so. We proudly proclaim that 3/4 of the peoples of the world are colored. We have the privilege of noticing in our generation the great drama of freedom and independence as it unfolds in Asia and Africa. All of these things are in line with the unfolding work of providence. But we must be sure that we accept them in the right spirit. We must not seek to use our emerging freedom and our growing power to do the same thing to the white minority that has been done to us for so many centuries. Our aim must never be to defeat or humiliate the white man. We must not become victimized with a philosophy of black supremacy. God is not interested merely in freeing black men and brown men and yellow men, but God is interested in freeing the whole human race. We must work with determination to create a society, not where black men are superior and other men are inferior and vice versa, but a society in which all men will live together as brothers and respect the dignity and worth of human personality. We must also avoid the temptation of being victimized with the psychology of victors. We have won marvelous victories. And through the work of the NAACP, we have been able to do some of the most amazing things of this generation. And I come this afternoon with nothing but praise for this great organization, the work that it has already done and the work that it will do in the future. And although they outlawed in Alabama and other states, the fact still remains that this organization has done more to achieve civil rights for Negroes than any other organization we can point to. And certainly this is fine. But we must not, however, remain satisfied with a court victory over our white brothers. We must respond to every decision with an understanding of those who have opposed us, and with an appreciation of the difficult adjustments that the court orders pose for them, we must act in such a way as to make possible a coming together of white people and colored people on the basis of a real harmony of interests and understanding. We must seek an integration based on mutual respect. I conclude by saying that each of us must keep faith in the future. Let us not despair. Let us realize that as we struggle for justice and freedom, we have cosmic companionship. This is the long faith of the Hebraic Christian tradition, that God is not some Aristotelian unmoved mover who merely contemplates upon himself. He's not merely a self-knowing God, but an ever-loving God, forever working through history for the establishment of his kingdom. And those of us who call the name of Jesus Christ find something of an event in our Christian faith that tells us this. That is something in our faith that says to us, never despair, never give up, never feel that the cause of righteousness and justice is doomed. That is something in our Christian faith at the center of it, which says to us that Good Friday may occupy the throne for a day, but ultimately it must give way to the triumphant beat of the drums of Easter. That is something in our faith that says evil may so shape events that Caesar will occupy the palace and Christ a cross. But one day that same Christ will rise up and split history into A.D. and B.C. so that even the life of Caesar must be dated by his name. There is something in this universe which justifies Carlyle in saying no lie can live forever. There is something in this universe which justifies William Cullen Bryant in saying truth crushed to earth will rise again. There is something in this universe which justifies James Russell Lowell in saying truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future. And behind the dim unknown stands God, within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. Go out with that faith today. Go back to your homes in the Southland to that faith, with that faith today. Go back to Philadelphia, to New York, to Detroit and Chicago with that faith today. That the universe is on our side in the struggle. Stand up for justice. Sometimes it gets hard, but it is always difficult to get out of Egypt. But the Red Sea always stands before you with discouraging dimensions. And even after you cross the Red Sea, you have to move through a wilderness with prodigious hilltops of evil and gigantic mountains of opposition. But I say to you, this afternoon, keep moving. Let nothing slow you up. Move on with dignity and honor and respectability. I realize that it will cause restless nights sometimes. It might cause losing a job. It will cause suffering and sacrifice. It might even cause physical death for some. But if physical death is the price that some must pay, to free their children from a permanent life of psychological death, yes, then nothing can be more Christian. Yes. Keep going today. Yes. Keep moving amid every obstacle. Yes. Keep moving amid every mounting of opposition. Yes. And if you will do that with dignity, when the history books are written in the future, the historians will have to look back and say, there lived a great people, yes, a people with fleecy locks and black complexion, but a people who injected new meaning into the veins of civilization, a people which stood up with dignity and honor and saved Western civilization in her darkest hour, a people that gave new integrity and a new dimension of love to our civilization. When that happens, the morning stars will sing together, yes, and the sons of God will shout for joy. Yes,
and that was Give Us the Ballot by Dr. Martin Luther King, delivered on May 17, 1957 in Washington, D.C. And once again, most of this week we're going to be listening to speeches and sermons of Dr. Martin Luther King in a somewhat chronological way. Happy Martin Luther King Day to all our listeners.